Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Inglés. Nivel avanzado. Comprensión oral. Tarea 1. Escuche la grabación. Elija la mejor opción. A, B o C. El texto se escuchará 3 veces. Ahora dispone usted de 2 minutos para leer las preguntas.
In matters of legal history, we often turn to Risa Golubov. We asked Risa to explain where these laws came from and why they were so controversial.
Protective legislation begins in the late 19th century with the rise of industrialization and factory work and long hours and poor conditions. State legislatures respond to that by trying to regulate the wages and hours and conditions of work. So protective legislation initially didn't have to mean only protective legislation for women.
It was regulation of the workplace.
Right. And to some extent, people thought it was more important to regulate women and children because they were physically different, they were weaker, they were not as capable of performing hard work.
And would most women at the time have agreed with that?
I think they would have. The assumption that men and women were physically different, biologically different, constitutionally different was pervasive. And most people would have agreed with that, absolutely. But one of the reasons that protective legislation becomes gendered and becomes so much more affiliated with women than being for everyone is the state of constitutional law in the late 19th and especially the early 20th century.
And what was that state?
So once states start regulating the conditions of labor, and the federal government too, start regulating the conditions of labor, the courts begin to worry about people's rights to contract, their liberty of contract. And the courts say, wait a second, people have a right to contract as they please. If they want to work 12 hours a day, if they want to work for low wages for 12 cents an hour, that's their prerogative. That's their constitutional right. Mm-hmm. But that constitutional right is limited to people who were thought to be capable of contracting on their own behalves.
So that we're not talking about physically capable now. We're talking about intellectually and mentally capable.
Exactly. The thinking was that women required more paternalistic intervention. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that they required that paternalistic intervention was precisely because they were physically different. Mm-hmm. They were more susceptible to coercion. They were more susceptible to bad conditions and illness, and especially their reproductive capacities. So they were at heart, even women who were factory workers were at heart mothers and potential mothers. Mm-hmm. And so there was a fear that if you worked them too hard, they wouldn't be able to propagate the race.
By the time of the New Deal in the 1930s, this notion of protecting workers is extended to all employees. After all, this is when we get the minimum wage, for instance.
That's exactly right.
What kind of new protective legislation emerges, if any, after World War II?
So one big question is whether you would call the protective legislation that emerges after World War II protective, because a lot of it is really aimed at excluding women from jobs that they held during the war. So women go into work during the war in huge numbers as men are away at the war, in war industries, in service jobs that they hadn't had before. And after the war, some of them retreat to the home. Some of them are pushed into the home by spouses and other things. And some are pushed into the home by laws. So, for example, bartending, a lot of women go into bartending. And after the war, states pass laws to restrict women and exclude them from bartending. And
so women had been bartending.
They had been during World War II.
So this is clearly opening up jobs.
Yes, clearly opening up jobs for men in order to keep women out. But the justification for that exclusion is it's dangerous to be a woman bartender.
So those were kind of wink, wink, nod, nod protections.
Yes.
When does this whole regime of protecting women begin to unravel? I'm assuming we don't have laws today that limit the number of hours that women can work or the kinds of occupations they can go into.
We don't have those kinds of laws for the most part, and they start to crumble in the 1960s.
Why is that?
So the real watershed is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VII prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in the workplace.
Was there any pushback? Were there women who felt that some genuine protections for women were in order and that these protective laws should stay in place?
Absolutely. There were different kinds of pushback. So some of the pushback was from people who thought that women really belong in the home. And so they weren't that excited about protecting women or giving women equal rights because they thought women and men were going to become too similar and too equal and that there was value to women and men playing different roles in society. So Phyllis Schlafly was the main proponent of the idea that women's place was in the home. And there was a real embrace of that among social conservatives in the 1970s and the 1980s.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
In matters of legal history, we often turn to Risa Golubov. We asked Risa to explain where these laws came from and why they were so controversial.
Protective legislation begins in the late 19th century with the rise of industrialization and factory work and long hours and poor conditions. State legislatures respond to that by trying to regulate the wages and hours and conditions of work. So protective legislation initially didn't have to mean only protective legislation for women.
It was regulation of the workplace.
Right. And to some extent, people thought it was more important to regulate women and children because they were physically different, they were weaker, they were not as capable of performing hard work.
And would most women at the time have agreed with that?
I think they would have. The assumption that men and women were physically different, biologically different, constitutionally different was pervasive. And most people would have agreed with that, absolutely. But one of the reasons that protective legislation becomes gendered and becomes so much more affiliated with women than being for everyone is the state of constitutional law in the late 19th and especially the early 20th century.
And what was that state?
So once states start regulating the conditions of labor, and the federal government too, start regulating the conditions of labor, the courts begin to worry about people's rights to contract, their liberty of contract. And the courts say, wait a second, people have a right to contract as they please. If they want to work 12 hours a day, if they want to work
for low
wages for 12 cents an hour, that's their prerogative. That's their constitutional right. Mm-hmm. But that constitutional right is limited to people who were thought to be capable of contracting on their own behalves.
So that we're not talking about physically capable now. We're talking about intellectually and mentally capable.
Exactly. The thinking was that women required more paternalistic intervention. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that they required that paternalistic intervention was precisely because they were physically different. Mm-hmm. They were more susceptible to coercion. They were more susceptible to bad conditions and illness, and especially their reproductive capacities. So they were at heart, even women who were factory workers were at heart mothers and potential mothers. Mm-hmm. And so there was a fear that if you worked them too hard, they wouldn't be able to propagate the race.
By the time of the New Deal in the 1930s, this notion of protecting workers is extended to all employees. After all, this is when we get the minimum wage, for instance.
That's exactly right.
What kind of new protective legislation emerges, if any, after World War II?
So one big question is whether you would call the protective legislation that emerges after World War II protective, because a lot of it is really aimed at excluding women from jobs that they held during the war. So women go into work during the war in huge numbers as men are away at the war, in war industries, in service jobs that they hadn't had before. And after the war, some of them retreat to the home. Some of them are pushed into the home by spouses and other things. And some are pushed into the home by laws. So, for example, bartending, a lot of women go into bartending. And after the war, states pass laws to restrict women and exclude them from bartending. And
so women had been bartending.
They had been during World War II.
So this is clearly opening up jobs.
Yes, clearly opening up jobs for men in order to keep women out. But the justification for that exclusion is it's dangerous to be a woman bartender.
So those were kind of wink, wink, nod, nod protections.
Yes.
When does this whole regime of protecting women begin to unravel? I'm assuming we don't have laws today that limit the number of hours that women can work or the kinds of occupations they can go into.
We don't have those kinds of laws for the most part, and they start to crumble in the 1960s.
Why is that?
So the real watershed is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VII prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in the workplace.
Was there any pushback? Were there women who felt that some genuine protections for women were in order and that these protective laws should stay in place?
Absolutely. There were different kinds of pushback. So some of the pushback was from people who thought that women really belong in the home. And so they weren't that excited about protecting women or giving women equal rights because they thought women and men were going to become too similar and too equal and that there was value to women and men playing different roles in society. So Phyllis Schlafly was the main proponent of the idea that women's place was in the home. And there was a real embrace of that among social conservatives in the 1970s and the 1980s.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
In matters of legal history, we often turn to Risa Golubov. We asked Risa to explain where these laws came from and why they were so controversial.
Protective legislation begins in the late 19th century with the rise of industrialization and factory work and long hours and poor conditions. State legislatures respond to that by trying to regulate the wages and hours and conditions of work. So protective legislation initially didn't have to mean only protective legislation for women.
It was regulation of the workplace.
Right. And to some extent, people thought it was more important to regulate women and children because they were physically different, they were weaker, they were not as capable of performing hard work.
And would most women at the time have agreed with that?
I think they would have. The assumption that men and women were physically different, biologically different, constitutionally different was pervasive. And most people would have agreed with that, absolutely. But one of the reasons that protective legislation becomes gendered and becomes so much more affiliated with women than being for everyone is the state of constitutional law in the late 19th and especially the early 20th century.
And what was that state?
So once states start regulating the conditions of labor, and the federal government too, start regulating the conditions of labor, the courts begin to worry about people's rights to contract, their liberty of contract. And the courts say, wait a second, people have a right to contract as they please. If they want to work 12 hours a day, if they want to work
for low
wages for 12 cents an hour, that's their prerogative. That's their constitutional right. Mm-hmm. But that constitutional right is limited to people who were thought to be capable of contracting on their own behalves.
So that we're not talking about physically capable now. We're talking about intellectually and mentally capable.
Exactly. The thinking was that women required more paternalistic intervention. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that they required that paternalistic intervention was precisely because they were physically different. Mm-hmm. They were more susceptible to coercion. They were more susceptible to bad conditions and illness, and especially their reproductive capacities. So they were at heart, even women who were factory workers were at heart mothers and potential mothers. Mm-hmm. And so there was a fear that if you worked them too hard, they wouldn't be able to propagate the race.
By the time of the New Deal in the 1930s, this notion of protecting workers is extended to all employees. After all, this is when we get the minimum wage, for instance.
That's exactly right.
What kind of new protective legislation emerges, if any, after World War II?
So one big question is whether you would call the protective legislation that emerges after World War II protective, because a lot of it is really aimed at excluding women from jobs that they held during the war. So women go into work during the war in huge numbers as men are away at the war, in war industries, in service jobs that they hadn't had before. And after the war, some of them retreat to the home. Some of them are pushed into the home by spouses and other things. And some are pushed into the home by laws. So, for example, bartending, a lot of women go into bartending. And after the war, states pass laws to restrict women and exclude them from bartending. And
so women had been bartending.
They had been during World War II.
So this is clearly opening up jobs.
Yes, clearly opening up jobs for men in order to keep women out. But the justification for that exclusion is it's dangerous to be a woman bartender.
So those were kind of wink, wink, nod, nod protections.
Yes.
When does this whole regime of protecting women begin to unravel? I'm assuming we don't have laws today that limit the number of hours that women can work or the kinds of occupations they can go into.
We don't have those kinds of laws for the most part, and they start to crumble in the 1960s.
Why is that?
So the real watershed is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VII prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in the workplace.
Was there any pushback? Were there women who felt that some genuine protections for women were in order and that these protective laws should stay in place?
Absolutely. There were different kinds of pushback. So some of the pushback was from people who thought that women really belong in the home. And so they weren't that excited about protecting women or giving women equal rights because they thought women and men were going to become too similar and too equal and that there was value to women and men playing different roles in society. So Phyllis Schlafly was the main proponent of the idea that women's place was in the home. And there was a real embrace of that among social conservatives in the 1970s and the 1980s.
¿Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas? Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Escuche la grabación. Indique sus respuestas en la casilla correspondiente. El texto se escuchará 3 veces. Ahora dispone usted de 2 minutos para leer las preguntas.
Extract 1.
How do we know if our child has obesity issues?
Well, you know, when parents, I would like to think that when parents look at their children, that they don't see an obese child, that they see a child that they love. And most parents don't perceive their child as overweight or obese. And so when they come into their doctor's office, frequently parents are a little surprised to have that information given to them because their perception is different. And that's wonderful. They should look at their kids and think their kids look fine. However, you do need to take the advice of your medical care provider when they say there are some things you need to change in your family to make your child healthier.
And it is a family affair.
Yes, it very, very frequently is a family affair. You know, there are some genetic defects that can cause obesity, but those things are very, very rare. Almost always when children are overweight or obese, it's because of environmental or behavioral factors that are going on in the home or in the school.
Extract 2.
Mostly behavioral factors are probably what I want to talk about, because in children we are seeing a trend now that children are not taking PE regularly in school. And I don't want to admit my age on the air, but when I was young, PE was at least an hour daily at any school system, and now children frequently have the option to opt out of PE. And so you're not getting as much physical exercise during the day. The other problem is Springfield, specifically, is becoming more urban. And as you become more urban, parents don't feel safe letting their children out play in the neighborhood, ride their bikes up and down the street and things like that. So if we don't have enough green space, there's not enough places for kids to go and run actively. The third thing is media and video. I always tell parents you can reward your child with more video time for time spent outside. Mm-hmm. So for every 30 minutes spent outside, you can have 15 minutes more on the video. I think that that's fine, as long as they're physically active when they're outside.
Extract 3.
One of the things with the media and video is that kids, when they're sedentary, tend to eat and snack. So just because you're sedentary already, but then you tend to snack while you're doing it. So that's one problem. The other problem is, especially here in America, we are very fast food oriented. And I always tell parents, take the S out of that. It's fat food. And when you're stopping and eating and you're in a rush, you're not making good food decisions. Most fast food restaurants do have healthier sides, but you have to make a conscious effort to order those. And I always tell parents, ask them for a calorie list. They have to supply that to you. And you'll be surprised at what your children's favorite foods is, the poor nutritional value and how many calories are in it. So you do have to be careful.
Extract 4.
Right. It has to start with the family, because children model after their parents. Their parents are their best model. And so parents have to become healthier when they're thinking about having a child or they have children in their home, because you're their best model. And so, unfortunately, for parents who maybe have a lifetime of bad habits, they have to make some changes. They have to add, you know, you're supposed to have 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And so getting in 5 servings of fruits and vegetables without that including juice, because juice is not a whole food. I want them eating 5 fruits and vegetables. And so that's a tough thing. The other thing you could do for your children is remove calories from what they're drinking. Children over the age of 3 do not need fat in their milk. Give them skim milk. Make them drink water. Mm-hmm. And I use this little trick in my office that I have parents add 2 ounces of a cranberry juice cocktail, like cran grape, and add it to a gallon of water. It flavors the water just enough, but it's a very low calorie content and a low sugar content.
Extract 5.
Well, the best thing for families, especially if you have a family history of obesity, the best thing you could do for your child is to breastfeed, because research shows that breastfeeding actually decreases obesity in adulthood. So even a chubby breastfed baby is less likely to be obese in adulthood. There are good formulas out there, and formulas can benefit your baby. But the other mistake people make is they're so anxious to give their children solid foods that they start at too early of an age. Solids should not be added to a baby's diet until after 4 to 6 months of age. And then you should start with the cereals and vegetables, not with fruits, where you end up giving your baby a sweet tooth that sticks with them the rest of their life.
Ahora dispone usted de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Extract 1.
How do we know if our child has obesity issues?
Well, you know, when parents, I would like to think that when parents look at their children, that they don't see an obese child, that they see a child that they love. And most parents don't perceive their child as overweight or obese. And so when they come into their doctor's office, frequently parents are a little surprised to have that information given to them because their perception is different. And that's wonderful. They should look at their kids and think their kids look fine. However, you do need to take the advice of your medical care provider when they say there are some things you need to change in your family to make your child healthier.
And it is a family affair.
Yes, it very, very frequently is a family affair. You know, there are some genetic defects that can cause obesity, but those things are very, very rare. Almost always when children are overweight or obese, it's because of environmental or behavioral factors that are going on in the home or in the school.
Extract 2.
Mostly behavioral factors are probably what I want to talk about, because in children we are seeing a trend now that children are not taking PE regularly in school. And I don't want to admit my age on the air, but when I was young, PE was at least an hour daily at any school system. And now children frequently have the option to opt out of PE. And so you're not getting as much physical exercise during the day. The other problem is Springfield, specifically, is becoming more urban. And as you become more urban, parents don't feel safe letting their children out play in the neighborhood, ride their bikes up and down the street and things like that. So if we don't have enough green space, there's not enough places for kids to go and run actively. The third thing is media and video. I always tell parents you can reward your child with more video time for time spent outside. So for every 30 minutes spent outside, you can have 15 minutes more on the video. I think that that's fine as long as they're physically active when they're outside.
Extract 3.
One of the things with the media and video is that kids, when they're sedentary, tend to eat and snack. So just because you're sedentary already, but then you tend to snack while you're doing it. So that's one problem. The other problem is, especially here in America, we are very fast food oriented. And I always tell parents, take the S out of that. It's fat food. And when you're stopping and eating and you're in a rush, you're not making good food decisions. Most fast food restaurants do have healthier sides, but you have to make a conscious effort to order those. And I always tell parents, ask them for a calorie list. They have to supply that to you. And you'll be surprised at what your children's favorite foods is, the poor nutritional value and how many calories are in it. So you do have to be careful.
Extract 4.
Right. It has to start with the family because children model after their parents. Their parents are their best model. And so parents have to become healthier when they're thinking about having a child or they have children in their home because you're their best model. And so unfortunately for parents who maybe have a lifetime of bad habits, they have to make some changes. They have to add, you know, you're supposed to have 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And so getting in 5 servings of fruits and vegetables without that including juice, because juice is not a whole food. I want them eating 5 fruits and vegetables. And so that's a tough thing. The other thing you could do for your children is remove calories from what they're drinking. Children over the age of 3 do not need fat in their milk. Give them skim milk, make them drink water. And I use this little trick in my office that I have parents add 2 ounces of a cranberry juice cocktail, like cran grape, and add it to a gallon of water. It flavors the water just enough, but it's a very low calorie content and a low sugar content.
Extract 5.
Well, the best thing for families, especially if you have a family history of obesity, the best thing you could do for your child is to breastfeed, because research shows that breastfeeding actually decreases obesity in adulthood. So even a chubby breastfed baby is less likely to be obese in adulthood. There are good formulas out there, and formulas can benefit your baby. But the other mistake people make is they're so anxious to give their children solid foods that they start it too early of an age. Solids should not be added to a baby's diet until after 4 to 6 months of age. And then you should start with the cereals and vegetables, not with fruits, where you end up giving your baby a sweet tooth that sticks with them the rest of their life.
Ahora dispone usted de 1 minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Extract 1.
How do we know if our child has obesity issues?
Well, you know, when parents, I would like to think that when parents look at their children, that they don't see an obese child, that they see a child that they love. And most parents don't perceive their child as overweight or obese. And so when they come into their doctor's office, frequently parents are a little surprised to have that information given to them because their perception is different. And that's wonderful. They should look at their kids and think their kids look fine. However, you do need to take the advice of your medical care provider when they say there are some things you need to change in your family to make your child healthier.
And it is a family affair.
Yes, it very, very frequently is a family affair. You know, there are some genetic defects that can cause obesity, but those things are very, very rare. Almost always when children are overweight or obese, it's because of environmental or behavioral factors that are going on in the home or in the school.
Extract 2.
Mostly behavioral factors are probably what I want to talk about, because in children we are seeing a trend now that children are not taking PE regularly in school. And I don't want to admit my age on the air, but when I was young, PE was at least an hour daily at any school system. And now children frequently have the option to opt out of PE. And so you're not getting as much physical exercise during the day. The other problem is Springfield, specifically, is becoming more urban. And as you become more urban, parents don't feel safe letting their children out play in the neighborhood, ride their bikes up and down the street and things like that. So if we don't have enough green space, there's not enough places for kids to go and run actively. The third thing is media and video. I always tell parents you can reward your child with more video time for time spent outside. So for every 30 minutes spent outside, you can have 15 minutes more on the video. I think that that's fine as long as they're physically active when they're outside.
Extract 3.
One of the things with the media and video is that kids, when they're sedentary, tend to eat and snack. So just because you're sedentary already, but then you tend to snack while you're doing it. So that's one problem. The other problem is, especially here in America, we are very fast food oriented. And I always tell parents, take the S out of that. It's fat food. And when you're stopping and eating and you're in a rush, you're not making good food decisions. Most fast food restaurants do have healthier sides, but you have to make a conscious effort to order those. And I always tell parents, ask them for a calorie list. They have to supply that to you. And you'll be surprised at what your children's favorite foods is, the poor nutritional value and how many calories are in it. So you do have to be careful.
Extract 4.
Right. It has to start with the family because children model after their parents. Their parents are their best model. And so parents have to become healthier when they're thinking about having a child or they have children in their home because you're their best model. And so unfortunately for parents who maybe have a lifetime of bad habits, they have to make some changes. They have to add, you know, you're supposed to have 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And so getting in 5 servings of fruits and vegetables without that including juice, because juice is not a whole food. I want them eating 5 fruits and vegetables. And so that's a tough thing. The other thing you could do for your children is remove calories from what they're drinking. Children over the age of 3 do not need fat in their milk. Give them skim milk, make them drink water. And I use this little trick in my office that I have parents add 2 ounces of a cranberry juice cocktail, like cran grape, and add it to a gallon of water. It flavors the water just enough, but it's a very low calorie content and a low sugar content.
Extract 5.
Well, the best thing for families, especially if you have a family history of obesity, the best thing you could do for your child is to breastfeed, because research shows that breastfeeding actually decreases obesity in adulthood. So even a chubby breastfed baby is less likely to be obese in adulthood. There are good formulas out there, and formulas can benefit your baby. But the other mistake people make is they're so anxious to give their children solid foods that they start at too early of an age. Solids should not be added to a baby's diet until after 4 to 6 months of age. And then you should start with the cereals and vegetables, not with fruits, where you end up giving your baby a sweet tooth that sticks with them the rest of their life.
Ahora dispone usted de 1 minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2.